This is Michael Kaiser, and you're listening to the Good Beer Hunting Podcast. Welcome back to another episode of the GBH Collective, where we bring you the stories behind the stories from our writers and photographers all over the world, and from our studio team based here in Chicago. These bonus episodes are made possible by our subscribers and underwriters. GBH is partially underwritten by Guinness, who we're collaborating with for our Coming to America series. Guinness began brewing and never stopped at St. James Gate in Dublin in 1759, and has been shipping beer to America since 1817. And recently, they celebrated that distribution to the U.S. with their 200th anniversary export stout. We've also just taken on New Belgium as an underwriting partner as well, who will be helping us focus on the evolving world of wild and sour ales, as drinkers around the world seek out new beer experiences that increasingly occupy a place in our lives once reserved for wine. How do we talk about these beers, buy and sell them, or integrate them into new bar and restaurant concepts? We'll be publishing stories in that vein shortly. And of course, we're also supported by the Fervent Few, a growing community of hundreds of GBH readers, including some professional supporters. From the UK, we have Cloudwater Brew Co., Four Pure Brewing Company, Magic Rock Brewing, Honest Brew, Siren Craft Brew, Two Tribes Brewing, Beer Hawk, Northern Monk Brew Co., Boundary Brewing in Belfast, and Ireland Craft Beers, an exporter. In the US, we have the Mitten Bar up in Ludington, Michigan, Lord Hobo in Massachusetts, Sound Growler Brewing in Tinley Park, Illinois, 1911 Established Cider and Spirits from New York, and then there's Devil Peak of Signal Hill Products in Cape Town, South Africa, all supporting us through their monthly pro-tier subscriptions. You can join the Fervent Few yourself by visiting goodbeerhunting.com/ferventfew. This week, we've got Kyle Kostronik from Ohio, who was GBH's first new voice way back in 2014. And recently, we launched a sub-blog of sorts for Kyle, where he explores his own perceptions of beer and the ever-evolving culture that surrounds it. We also talked to Claire Bullen, a writer we recently brought on, who's based in London but originally from the States. Her recent profile of The Colonel is one of my favorite pieces we've ever published. She also recently made time to write about beer and cheesesteaks on a stop in Philly. We'll get the stories behind all those stories in this episode of the GBH Collective. Listen in. All right. Thanks for joining me, Kyle.
Of course.
We are going to talk today about your new blog that lives inside of the Good Beer Hunting blog, and you've called it Banquet and Chill.
Yes.
Why did you want a new blog?
It was a couple reasons. I was getting a little bit, bored isn't the right word, but just a little bit tired of the longer form signifiers. There's obviously still value there to them, but with the way that my day job is, it's a lot easier for me to sit down every week or two and write 700 words than it is to try to sit down and write 2,500. So I wanted something that was a little bit shorter form, something that would force me to write on a more regular basis. But then also something that was just a little bit more lighthearted and fun, and a little bit more about the culture surrounding the beer than the beer itself.
Yeah, I mean, I've heard you use the word disillusioned before when describing kind of what it felt like to kind of go about doing the work of writing one of these longer profile pieces on a single brewery that we call signifiers. Does that map at all to, I guess, you're also, your personal interest as a drinker at this point? Do you feel somewhat disillusioned or disconnected from some of those deeper dives?
A little bit here and there. I mean, part of my feeling on that is that so many of the stories, especially about younger brewers right now, are very similar to one another. I think what GBH has done really well is been able to find those stories that are different or are unique or have something really special about them. And just as I started to, especially last year, look at the breweries that I was interested in and did some digging on my own, I wasn't able to find that kind of unique nugget in there that I could really dig into and use as the basis of a piece. And I think that's sort of what got me more interested in this the culture surrounding it, and this idea of looking at beer as the connective tissue between people, rather than it being an actual story about the people making the beer.
Yeah, at the because sometimes I guess even GBH maybe at its worst, I sometimes think of as a bit earnest and precious about certain things. And what I see mm-hmm. you writing right now, I'm looking specifically at your latest post, which you called Bison Fight, is the opposite of that in almost every way. It's short and energetic, and it's about drinking and watching nature movies. And that's something of an entirely different tone and intent than anything we've published before. I mean,
definitely.
So that must have been kind of like, I know you've been kind of battling for a while as to like what you wanted your voice to be as it kind of became its own thing. Because you started writing for us years ago now about like doing really deep dives into things like the Ohio beer scene, like Cleveland and Cincinnati and Columbus. And then you ventured out to do Signifiers. And then you've done a little bit more of the travel story piece. And now I kind of see you kind of going off and you're veering into your own direction where you're writing in, I don't want to call it an insular way, but it's a sort of like self-reflective, you know, from the point of view of one drinker kind of thing.
Definitely, yeah, and I'm still really interested in especially the travel writing. I find a lot of enjoyment and reward in that. But with the Banquet and Chill stuff, it was more about I think trying to come to terms with where I am as a drinker right now. But then also, I think a little bit of a counterpoint to some of the self-seriousness or the more argumentative side that I've been seeing so much on beer Twitter and on the Reddits and all that, just because what I felt a little bit like beer was being spoiled for me by the people that, you know, really go at it. And I kind of wanted to take a step back from that and sort of go on this journey and kind of rediscover all the things that I fell in love with about beer in the first place and try to put them out there in a way that was shorter and kind of had a lower barrier to entry so that maybe some other people along the way would be able to see the same thing in the way that they're interacting with beer.
Yeah, that's interesting. I mean, as the guy who publishes this thing, I think a lot of our audience tends to be people who take beer pretty seriously. And I think they find some commonality with the Good Beer Hunting platform because we do take it pretty seriously. And so it's interesting to me that there's, to think about this other broader audience that's out there who maybe has fun with beer or think it's interesting, but maybe not too serious. And, you know, they see it as a kind of this thing that intersects with other pieces of their life experience and culture and social norms and things like that. I wonder if that audience is going to find things like Bison Fight and feel some sense of resonance with a guy who's writing on a very, you know, what might be described as an overly earnest, somewhat too serious platform at times. I'm kind of curious to see what happens as that thing finds its own little niche on Twitter. Because I've already seen people tweeting about it that are not the people that normally talk to us.
Right. Yeah. And I think that's what I'm really interested to see also. And that idea of that high and low, the serious and the not, was kind of the jumping off point for the very first post, this idea where I dug into my love for Miller High Life, but then also talked about, you know, Jester King Swan being the favorite beer that I had in 2017. And just in all parts of my life, but in beer especially, I'm really intrigued by this idea of high and low and the shades of gray in between and what it means to, you know, be able to like something that is complex and precious and nuanced, but then also be able to, in the same breath, like something that is kind of the most basic form of that same thing. So I'm hoping that throughout all of this, I can kind of find out what those connection points are, whether it's something that I can discover along the way, or if it's something that these people that are starting to interact with it can share with me and enlighten me on.
When you think about the high-low, I think for a lot of, for GBH's audience, I think it's pretty easy for them to understand why things are interesting in the high part of that equation. Why is something like High Life, which would be the low, why is that equally interesting to you?
Well, I think the one thing, and I kind of touched on it in that first post, is that I think when you have something that's really, really simple and basic and kind of the people for the people, you kind of strip away all of the complication surrounding it. So you don't have to focus on tasting notes, or you don't have to worry about, you know, making sure that that this is a new thing that you're trying and that you're giving it the time and attention that it deserves. But instead you can kind of step back and enjoy your surroundings and not have to think about it as much, which, I mean, I guess my whole point of view on it is that I see both approaches to beer and to anything, you know, movies, books, culture, in that way, really valuable. Those times when you can sit down and, you know, watch a P.T. Anderson film and dissect it and think about it. But then also those times you can step back and watch Wayne's World and just kind of kick back and enjoy it. And the dichotomy there is something that just really intriguing to me, and something that I kind of want to dive into a little bit more.
And you might be that weird nerd that wants to sit back and watch Wayne's World and dissect Wayne's World.
Right, exactly.
Now, I saw most of the reaction to that first piece, where you kind of tried to outlay your high low and your love of high life. A lot of the reaction was really positive. It seemed like when I say that there were people talking to us who don't normally talk to us, there was like these voices that were expressing almost like a sense of relief. They were like, oh, thank God somebody is just talking about beer in the way that they like beer. And that was a really interesting sort of tone to hear coming through, especially through beer Twitter, which does not usually have that sense of relief at all. But then there was also a little bit of pushback, and it was small. But there was a little bit of pushback of people that were kind of interpreting what you were saying as, you know, why do you want people to care less? Like, why would that ever be a goal, especially around something like beer or craft beer in particular, which exists because they were able to convince people to care more? Mm-hmm. It must have been an awkward place to find yourself.
Yeah, I mean, but I think that's kind of, in some ways, that's kind of what I expected, because people who are really, really serious about something don't typically react well to being told that they shouldn't be as serious about it, because they place so much of their own self-identity into that seriousness. Mm. And I think the one thing that I was pleading for in a certain way was just to step back and take a look at yourself and see if these are really the values that you want to base your identity around, if these are the things that you want to be known for. And if you are, that's cool too. I mean, I think the line in there that I took the most joy in writing was, everyone has a different float for their boat. So I think whatever it is that makes you happy, that's great. I don't think that can come at the expense of others and what makes them happy.
Now, that kind of gets summed up in the tagline that you've written for your blog. So again, the blog is called Banquet and Chill. The tagline is, a common sense approach to drinking in the 21st century, which to me is really humorous, because it reminds me of all these books I saw as a young teenager that were basically like, you know, how to be a man, or like how to be successful in life and make friends. And like these like really simple primers that were written for, you know, that young adult audience. So a common sense approach to drinking in the 21st century has this, like, it couldn't sound more boring. And yet I think the entire point, of course, is for it to be lighthearted.
Absolutely. Yeah. And it's funny, a coworker of mine was just recently telling me about a book that he's reading called The Subtle Art of Not Giving a Fuck, which is all about being able to take a step back, whether it's, you know, with your job or with, you know, really anything that you're going up against in life, being able to step back and realize that it's probably not that important in the end. And once you kind of realize that, that's the key to unlocking to the actual way to be successful. And he said something to me. He was like, yeah, I was going to tell you about it, but then I feel like you're kind of already doing that, which I got a good laugh over and really appreciated, because I feel like, especially over the last couple of years, that's kind of the point that I've reached, both in my professional career, but then also when it comes to the beer side of things, of just being able to put everything into context in the actual impact that it has on me and the people that I care about, and being able to kind of have its own place and time dedicated to it, but not allowing it to really control anything or monopolize my time.
Hmm. Was there an aha moment for you somewhere along the way when you feel like that idea started to really crystallize?
I don't know that it was a singular moment. I think it was something that was building pretty slowly over time, that I kind of didn't really have a word for or a keen insight into. But I do remember when I traveled over to Europe in 2016 and the time that I spent in Copenhagen and mm-hmm. just the way that the culture was there and the way that people approached those kind of social interactions with one another. And, you know, it being such a huge capital of great food and great beer, but that not being the priority for anyone when they went out for the evening, it really being about that more convivial nature and spending time and catching up with, you know, people that you care about. And I think that when I saw that and kind of had a moment to step back and think about it when I was writing the travel piece about Copenhagen is when I kind of started connecting all those dots that had been slowly building up in my mind.
Hmm. And so, I mean, they're not known, of course, for the Copenhagen has quite an advanced, progressive craft beer scene there, far more advanced than, you know, many US cities. And so it's not that it's lacking for interest in those products. Like there's clearly a passion for those. People are really interested in those. They're analyzing them. They're drinking them. But not necessarily letting them get in the way, it sounds like, of, you know, what the baseline experience is of going out and drinking some beers.
Yeah. And I mean, I think the one thing that was kind of eye-opening for me is going out to these places that had, you know, just killer draft lists and really great beer available and not seeing a single person on their phone, whether it was looking up somebody else's tasting notes for the beer or checking into it, or even just, you know, having a side conversation with somebody that wasn't there. They were all kind of earnestly focused on the people that they were surrounding themselves with. And that was something to me that it reminded me of, you know, when I used to go out to bars with my parents as a kid and the way that it really was this kind of communal thing where that was their one time in the week where they would get to see this certain subset of people in their lives and kind of catch up on what's been happening. And it just reminded me of something a little bit simpler and I think a little bit more true. And when we came back from Europe, then that's something that I actively tried to do when I went out was to kind of keep my phone in my pocket, not worry too much about, you know, what beer I was going to order, but really just focus on the people that I was spending that time with.
Yeah. There's a brewery here in Chicago called Maplewood, which recently just opened their tap room. And they designed it to feel a little bit like a, you know, an after shift Chicago neighborhood bar. And it's amazing the profound effect that has on even my own psychology and behavior when I'm in that space. I don't necessarily feel like I'm at a brewery. I feel like I'm in a neighborhood bar. And I find mm-hmm. myself just sitting down and talking to people and going there with one or two people, you know, to have a good time out and to catch up with them versus go drink all the Maplewood beers and figure out what they have on tap and like looking it up before I go and thinking about right. it while I'm there. Like I'm going there and I find myself drinking the same kind of two or three beers that I tend to drink from them, their IPA and their pale ale especially. And then venturing a little bit, but not really letting that become why I'm there and what we're talking about. I find myself relaxing a lot more there. So it tells me a lot about, I think, about the cues that we even send in the spaces that we drink in the States. The more and more that we're abandoning bars and going to brewery tap rooms, we're kind of adopting a different set of values when we go into those spaces. We're adopting the values of this beer is the most important thing here because those spaces are right. designed to communicate that. And I think that's going to be a really tricky thing for us to kind of evolve out of as, you know, as craft beer becomes a bit more of a staple in most of our lives. It becomes the places we drink more often than not. I think we have to kind of sort through some of those issues and priorities and values.
Definitely. Yeah. And I think that's part of the reason why I find myself frequenting dive bars so often. And I think the dive bars that I'm most drawn to are the ones that, you know, are exactly what you picture when you think of a dive bar, but then they have, you know, three or four taps of something that's local, but it's not the newest thing or the most crazy thing. It's just, you know, the local pales, the local IPAs, the local lagers, stuff like that. And on the flip side though, when I think of a place like Brewery Bavana and what they've done with their space and kind of this amalgamation they've built, and the feeling that you get when you walk in there, you know, you walk in and even though it is really a half of it is the tap room and half of it is the restaurant, you never get the feeling that beer is the most important thing that's happening there. And the culture that they've built up around that and the sense of community that you get when you walk in there, I think is probably their biggest achievement so far, in the sense that the beers that they're making are, some of them are incredibly complex and incredibly, you know, nuanced beers, but you never feel like you need to focus on that. It's something that kind of disarms you and puts you into a completely different state of mind.
You got another piece on the way for Banquet and Chill. What's it going to be about?
Yeah, it is. Well, it's going live in a couple hours from now. But it is it's called Mount Crushmore, and it's this idea.
Is this just a blog for all of your terrible puns?
Yes, pretty much. But it's this idea of kind of your personal beer hall of fame, and which, you know, if you had to pick the four beers that you would go back to again and again and again, what would they be? And so I dive into that a little bit, and then talk about the four that are on my personal Mount Crushmore, and talk about kind of what they mean to me and why I think they deserve a spot there. And again, it's definitely not the most surprising list. I think, you know, a few of the beers on there are ones that a lot of people would probably associate with. But it was a really fun exercise to me to kind of sit down and think about the beers that have been most impactful to me throughout my time drinking, but then also the ones that I would be absolutely heartbroken if, you know, tomorrow they just disappeared.
Oh man, give me an example of that.
Also, so the four that were on my list were Sierra Nevada Pale Ale, Bell's Two Hearted, Coors Banquet, and Orval. And I can honestly tell you that if any one of those beers just ceased to exist, I would be completely heartbroken and I wouldn't know what to do, because those are four beers that I constantly have stocked in my fridge. Not to say that I drink them all the time, but they're just those really familiar ones that I like to go back to and kind of my North Star as far as tasting goes, and a really great way to kind of reset my palate and recalibrate my thinking.
And those are all beers that I think, you know, they communicate that they want to be there every day. Like, there's something about the way that they're presented, the way they're named, the style of them, like everything about them tells you that they want to be around. You know, they're not looking for you to taste and move on and jot down notes and never return. You know, they're not those kind of beers.
Definitely. Yeah. And even that being said though, I kind of have different occasions for each one where I enjoy them the most, which I think is really interesting, because for as much as they have in common, they are really, really different. And I think kind of serve different purposes in the way I interact with them.
That's cool. I'm looking forward to reading that. It's definitely going to be a nice continuation of this new tone that you're setting on Good Beer Hunting. I got to tell you, as somebody who, you know, you were the first writer that we ever published outside of myself, and you've continued to take the platform slightly in your direction ever since. it's been fun for me to just kind of like slowly let go of that hug and let you play with it. And you've been doing a great job. I really enjoy it. I like being one of your fans.
Thanks. Yeah. And I think more than anything, I'm just really excited to be able to kind of lend this different dimension to GBH and complement the, you know, longer form, writing that everyone else is doing. And I'm just really, really hoping to keep up with Curtis as far as the blog posts go.
Yeah. Good luck. Although I think you're well ahead of him already. You're a planner. He's not a planner.
Yeah.
Thanks, Kyle. We really appreciate it.
Yeah, take it easy.
All right, Claire Bullen, welcome to your first Good Beer Hunting Collective podcast.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
So I'm really excited. You were recruited by our new UK editor, Matthew Curtis. He was a big fan of yours, but I had never read anything by you before. And so I was really curious to see what your first piece for Good Beer Hunting was going to be like. And it almost broke my heart how good it was. This piece that you wrote about the Colonel was as poetic as anything we've ever published.
Wow, well, thanks. trying to break hearts out here.
Not to just immediately flatter you. But I was really,
I also found it to be, based on what I know of the kernel, just from, you know, things that, stories that people have told me, or, you know, the things they've talked about that they like about it, it also seemed really fitting to have your voice kind of bringing their story to life. And I think that's one of the things that Matthew was really keen on, was he specifically wanted Claire to do the kernel story because he thought you would do it in a way that nobody else would. So I wanted to hear a little bit more about your kind of point of view on the kernel and why for you that became your first story for Good Beer Hunting.
Yeah. So I think I was aware all throughout this process that I had to get this right. And part of that was just, I think this was my first piece, as you say, so you want to make a good first impression, of course, but the kernel in London is so significant. And I think even though Evan is one of the most humble guys in beer and will never, ever admit to basically any of the plaudits that are thrown his way, you know, the brewery has been hugely influential. And I think it's fair to say that the beer scene here just wouldn't exist the way it does without him and without the kernel. So it's also commonly considered one of the first, you know, contemporary craft breweries in the city. It's been around longer than anyone else from this new generation. So there's a lot of time to account for too. So I think I went into it really intentional about wanting to make the vision of the brewery feel as fair as possible, and also as representative as possible of its enduring influence, without kind of just lapsing into superlatives, which I think it's so easy to do with them. It's like, this beer is fantastic, best beer in London. And like, it's very easy to do that. It's like, I tried to sort of strike a balance between being, you know, a little bit removed and striving for some kind of objectivity while still saying like, no, this is a really important brewery that you need to know about.
Now, I know in the US, as sort of new generations of brewers have come up, many of them, there's a good bit of time and distance between the sort of progenitors of the scene in their towns and what they are now doing as brewers. And sometimes I feel like that thread isn't so obvious anymore as to some of those people that really paved the way and made it possible for them. Do you find that brewers in London are still very connected to some of those origins of their scene, or do you find it kind of, do you find that time and distance sort of pulling them apart a little bit?
Well, for starters, I think my perspective is always going to be slightly askew because I moved to London in 2013. So, you know, things are already kind of well underway at that point. And also, obviously, I don't brew, so I can only say as much as I can from an outsider's perspective how much everyone has been influenced by what's going on. But from my sort of, you know, subjective experience, it does seem to me that that's still very much part of the conversation. You know, you talk to a whole generation of brewers, like people in the article I quoted, like Dave Seymour at Brew by Numbers and James Rylance, who is now starting his own project out in Cornwall, but who was with Red Church up until recently. Mm-hmm. And they talk very explicitly about how, you know, like, our breweries wouldn't exist without Evan and the Kernel, but this whole scene wouldn't exist without Evan and the Kernel. So, so it does seem like people are still, you know, really close knit and really playing off each other. And my impression of the scene here is that because it was still kind of nascent, even only a few years ago, now it's a little bit more mature, but that, you know, people are really aware of what other people are doing. Every new brewery kind of, you know, makes a splash and lands in a certain way. And so it feels like there's kind of a big, broad conversation going on that a lot of people are involved in. So that's a really nice thing to see.
So in 2013, so you were in London when the Kernel still had their taproom open.
Yes. Yeah. Some of my like best early memories of the Kernel are actually going to that tap room and going along the Bermondsey Beer Mile, which is that sort of stretch in South London where a number of breweries are clustered. And it's basically, it's open Friday nights too, but for a while it was only open on Saturdays. So it was this big thing to go down on Saturday mornings and you'd kind of do a crawl among all the breweries, but you would also, you know, there's tons of artisanal food producers down there too. So you'd go to the bakery and get a loaf of sourdough, you know, you'd go get coffee and pastries at this other place. You would get cheese at Neil's Yard Dairy, and you'd kind of make a whole scavenge picnic for yourself. And then you'd bring it to the Colonel and sit on one of the picnic tables inside and have your awesome picnic. And then you'd go back for beer after beer. And that was, for a long time, one of the best London experiences any beer person could have.
It got quite popular, though.
But then, yeah, exactly. It became a victim of its own success. So I think, you know, gradually it was like the lines got longer and longer. You suddenly had to wait 20, 25 minutes in line to get your second beer. And it was so crowded, you couldn't get a seat at any of the tables. And then the vibe started changing then. So it's been closed for, I think, 2 years now. And it's sort of a shame they haven't found a way yet to bring it back, because it was so great in its prime. So I'm still sort of hopeful that'll happen eventually.
And they basically closed it because they didn't like it that way either.
Exactly. Yeah. They said they weren't happy with the hospitality experience they were offering, which I think is sort of, it's funny because they could, you know, get so much attention and hype and probably make a good amount of money doing this every weekend. But it seems so exemplary of Evan's integrity that they opted to, like, no, you know, this isn't ideal. We're just not going to do this. And they left it at that. So I think the reasons behind it are totally fair and valid. I think there were some ideas being thrown around for a while about, you know, being able to book in advance or doing it in a way that's ticketed. But I imagine that would feel kind of exclusionary and might sort of serve to stoke the hype in a way that Evan wouldn't be comfortable with either. So for now, it's sort of a stalemate. But he did talk about them potentially opening another space, potentially in Bermondsey, down the line. But so far, I think the details are still pretty sketchy.
Now, the way you describe going and getting some bread and cheese and walking over to the Colonel seems remarkably relevant to the last thing you just published for us, which was A Perfect Pour, which is a series that we have where, you know, as our writers travel and enjoy their lives in their own hometowns, and they find these moments where a beer just seems to slip, like, perfectly into its place and kind of present itself in its idyllic state. These sort of great moments that our writers are now kind of, you know, they're diving deep into those moments and trying to articulate what makes them so special and unique. You did that with a beer in Philadelphia alongside a cheesesteak.
Yes. Yes.
As humble as that sounds, it was a really beautiful story.
Thank you. Yeah, I think, I don't know, I'm sort of a sentimental creature in some ways. And, you know, the fact that I only get to go home to Philadelphia, living in London as I do, maybe once or twice a year now, sort of imbues every trip home with added significance that otherwise wouldn't be there. And I think a lot of my nostalgia are the things I miss most when I go back home, apart from, you know, family and friends, are food experiences and drink experiences. And especially because, you know, I love Tired Hands. I can't really get their beers over here. You know, I love Forest in Maine. I can't get their beers over here. So every trip home becomes kind of a race to hit up all of my favorite spots, and usually a very short window of time. And it is Philadelphia, so cheesesteaks are obviously kind of one of those essential experiences. So there's a really quirky deli just up the street from where my folks live out in the suburbs. It's actually called Our Deli. And there's a life-size fiberglass bull, which stands outside of it, this big black bull that is, like, you know, it wears a wreath at Christmas and it wears, like, a pilgrim hat on Thanksgiving, and it's like this really weird sort of like landmark. But the cheese sticks there are really good. You know, they do them exactly the way I like. The onions are perfectly fried. The cheese is, like, super gooey and melted in. And I think the Philly cheesesteak is both a food I feel very seriously about and one that is very hard to find outside of Philadelphia. You know, with any kind of quality.
There's one place in Chicago that I feel lives up to it, named Monty's, and it happens to be like a 5-block walk from my house, which is everything.
Oh, man.
So I'm basically raising my two boys, 4 years and 2 years old, on cheesesteaks.
That's a beautiful thing. And you don't believe in peppers on your steak,
I don't,
right?
No, I don't at all.
Okay.
I want just enough, yeah, I want just enough texture from the onions and a little bit of that smoky char from the onions, and that's it. No more, no peppers.
Totally, 100%. So yeah, so the pure cheesesteak is such a sort of lovely experience. So one thing we always do when I go home is we all pick up cheesesteaks from this deli. We'll pair it with whatever beer we have to hand, and we'll sit out on our deck if the weather is nice and kind of eat them in the sun, which is what this perfect pour was about. I'm lucky as well in that my younger brother has in the last couple of years gotten really into beer also. And he's still living in the Philadelphia area. So every time I come back from London at this point, he's got like a fridge full of awesome beers that he stashed like in advance of my return, which is so awesome. It's basically the best thing ever. And he's been really into this small brewery in Emmaus, Pennsylvania called Funk. And they're turning out really great IPAs there. So the previous winter when I was home, we had gone down to Funk and waited in like a 2-hour can line. It was like probably 20 degrees, absolutely freezing. And the beer was called Haze or Project Haze number 3. And it was really, really good. So that was quite a memorable experience and the beer was worth it, but it was also, you know, freezing and about an hour's drive away and kind of, it was, yeah, tricky to replicate. So the fact that their beers are now being carried in the local Wegmans made that a whole different experience.
Really?
I sort of wrote about that.
A wait-in-line hazy IPA is now available in a Wegmans. That is pretty special.
It's not the same IPA. It's one called Silent Disco that's actually now being contract brewed for them out in Chicago. So it's sort of a different approach. And it's not quite as good, but it is still – it was – quenching and it was very tasty and it went super well with those cheesesteaks and it just added up to one pretty great afternoon.
Well, it's one of the things I love about the Perfect Pour series is that it's not so much these rare, hard to get beers paired with these, you know, famous dishes or anything like that.
Right.
They really are moments as they emerge, like you finding that beer in your brother's fridge and then having a cheesesteak from the corner place that you like brings that into the context is what defines that as sort of a perfect pour moment.
Yeah, absolutely. It's kind of this wonderful moment of serendipity where, the forces just align. I think it was 80 degrees that day, even though it was the middle of October, super sunny.
What are you working on next?
So I've got a couple things in the pipeline. The one I'm really excited about is I've got another brewery profile coming up on these guys called Burnt Mill.
Okay.
So I actually just visited them 2 days ago. But they are a brand new brewery, less than a year old, out in Suffolk, which is about an hour and a half train ride from London, slightly northeast of the city. There's only three of them there. It's still really small, but they actually just won, Best New British Brewery, in this year's Rate Beer Awards. So they're getting a lot of attention and a lot of hype. So it was great to visit them and kind of see what was going on behind the scenes and drink some of their beers, which are just basically all fantastic. So that's the kind of next big piece I'm working on.
Awesome. Looking forward to that. Yeah. And I'll be coming to London in May for the Uppers and Downers Festival that we're doing there.
Yes.
I'm actually in the basement of Thalia Hall in Chicago right now because we have about 10 of us upstairs setting up for the Chicago version of that festival.
Oh, wow.
So it just feels like all I'm thinking about anymore is Uppers and Downers. But I'm excited about coming back to London in May and having a party there. And then my loose plan is to go south in the country, not maybe down to Bristol.
Okay.
And visit some of the breweries that you and Matthew have written about down there that I'm very keen to see.
Yeah.
So that should be fun.
Yeah, Bristol's more due west, but, you know, yeah, same thing. stick in the southern side of the country.
Towards the water.
Yeah, towards Wales and all that stuff. I mean, my British geography is like total trash, so who am I to lecture?
Yeah, who are you anyway?
Yeah, exactly.
Claire, thank you so much for talking with me. I appreciate all the sort of behind the scenes look at all of that. I know our readers really appreciate that too. Sometimes I wonder, you know, why this brewery, why now, that kind of thing. And I always find it fascinating to dig into some of the thinking behind that. And so I appreciate it. And we really appreciate having you on board. You've been a great addition, a great voice to add to the collaborative here of people that are trying their best to write the best stories they can about beer.
All right. Thank you so much. And thanks for that, Michael. It's a pleasure and a privilege to be involved.
You bet. Have a great day. See you soon.
Thanks. You too.